Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Of the act. I mean, yes, there was the concern that we wanted to get our land, but there was just as much comment in the legislative history that said we want to get jobs because our people are poor and nothing's going on, just like Chris said. I think that you're going to have a tougher road to hoe in areas where there are stronger interests to one side to go ahead and continue the communal economic aspect also. But I don't know. You know, there's that possibility. We have a way of looking at it within the regions to see who is at large, who is a village shareholder, to see who has that a little bit more of at stake. But other than that, I can't talk for anyone. Yeah.
Rosemary Maher, you wanted to speak.
Yes, in our region, selected a lot of land away from the villages for purposes of resources, and I think. What you're suggesting would be unacceptable because, excuse me, the main reason the selections were made was for the resources to provide jobs for the shareholders, and it's all related to the shareholders. Also, all the regional corporation shareholders that live in the villages are both shareholders of the village and the region, and I think it would be unwise to separate that out in. Even if the land was away from the village. Because if you're on a regional corporation level, you're still dealing with the same shareholders. The main reason was for economics for the villages and the region. The shareholders needed jobs. We have a project up in the Eagle Country up there that spent a lot of money on because we felt it would provide shareholders with jobs. So. I think it's related.
Dolly Garza and then Rosita.
What Rose said is true also in Southeast. Several of the village corporations selected land out of their immediate area. A majority of the land has been selected around Prince of Wales, and that was because of the value of the timber. But I think the Southeast Village corporations are all in a similar situation where they have a limited amount of land, unlike other village corporations. And the major perception of that land is economic development. And whether or not any of the village corporations would be willing to put that land in a land bank, time will tell. But if we're looking at economic development, and what he had stated earlier, that the land bank would be for land which would not go, which would have no economic value, then there is no land in Southeast that would go in the land bank. But I think what the village corporations are going to have to do is decide, divide it up, as Bart said, okay, what land will be used for private interest, say future land distributions, which Shaanxi is considering. What land of our 23,000 acres will be for commercial development, and what land will be for timber development, and then what land will be for communal use only. But I think the village corporations are going to have to decide that on their own.
Rosita?
I'm going to try to give a stab at answering Monroe's question over here. First of all, I think we have to deal with a couple of premises and sometimes I think maybe misconceptions about Native societies. And one is that there is this assumption that there wasn't individual property. From my knowledge, individual property, individual rights has always been a characteristic of Native societies, but we tend to focus only on the communal aspect. And then the other issue is that there are always, Native societies were never egalitarian societies, and so there were always rich people and always poor people, whether they were called chiefs or meliks or what. And so there was never, you know, an equal distribution of resources or land among Native people. But you know, to protect that, you know, that communal aspect.
theory that the profit-seeking corporation has as an element of its cost structure, the service on its non-debt capital, the dividends it's paying to all those passive shareholders.
Yeah, Dan, you say that a non-profit cannot distribute dividends. It cannot, I take it, distribute land either.
No, it cannot make distributions in cash or in kind. Right? It can, however, make services which would be below cost, and there are some questions that have been raised about nonprofits that then open the facilities which they operate to non-members, charge those members a higher amount than they make available to members, and whether there were problems with the statutory prohibition on nonprofit corporations, quote, making a profit. It's an area that is under reform. There is being circulated now a draft, a revision of Alaska's nonprofit law by the Alaska Code Revision Commission. I would urge you to get a hold of it and look at it. It's got a commentary that is hopefully designed to explain the law in English rather than just plain legalese to people so that they can see what's going on. The law became subject of a major hearing in the state last year in which it was attacked with vigor by religious corporations on the ground that they didn't like the disclosure requirements that were put in the act, because for the first time you had to make disclosure to members and there was a greater disclosure obligation to the state. So that's basically where nonprofit laws are. One other way in which nonprofits have as a rule that differ from profit-seeking entities, generally when you vote in a corporation that is organized under the for-profit laws and you vote at the shareholder level, you vote not on the notion that one shareholder gets one vote, it's weighted voting. And so the shareholder who has the largest number of votes casts those shares. Shareholder who has an insignificant number of shares has a rather insignificant voice in what decisions are made. In nonprofit corporations, since they don't have shares, the idea is one member, one vote. And that is a basic political quality of the nonprofit that you'd want to be aware of and you'd want to look at. Now, what about co-ops? I indicated yesterday that the law on cooperatives in the state of Alaska is very, very, it's undeveloped area. We have two basic co-op statutes, Title 10, Section 15, Title 10, Section 25. 25 deals with what are called telephone and telegraphic cooperatives, and they're not under review at all. The other deals with all other cooperative ventures. It is under review. There is a working paper that has been prepared, which is a public document for the Code Revision Commission, which costs the state of Alaska money, and it belongs to every citizen of the state of Alaska if they'd like one, which talks about what the basic...
over. It's chartered under federal law, and there's no way under federal law it can be taken over. It's a sovereign government. It has attributes of sovereignty. The same thing is true of a traditional government, whether recognized or not. There's no takeover possibility for that. The members control it. Fractionalization. If the land is in a, this is a problem that we were talking about this morning in various contexts. It would eliminate the problem of fractionalization because membership in the IRA is determined by Indianness or nativeness, however the definition of that IRA is set up. You're quarter blood or more and a descendant of a member, whether you're a member. But it's not a question of fractionalized interest. Powers of distribution. An IRA is a typical government. It can distribute its assets. It can use the assets for the common good. It would be limited by the Indian Civil Rights Act, by the concept of equal protection. It could not give all the assets to the Jones family and leave out all the other people in the community, but it could do things on the basis of need, of health considerations, of need for economic development, and so forth. It could act, in other words, as any government can act.
Monroe, would you like to go on from there?
No, I just wanted to ask Ralph left out governance. Yeah, and do what?
Governance of lands, unless you're leaving that for the...
Yeah, I didn't speak to the governance question, but the IRA, you're asking how it's governed. I mean, it's governed...
No, the governance of the land, what you may be pretermitting the sovereignty question, that is to say...
I'm not sure what you mean.
Yeah. The government as government over the lands that are subject to the IRA.
Oh, I see. Well,
criminal law,
I was leaving that
law.
Question. If the transfer of the land goes to the IRA, it's a very interesting sub-question, and that is whether the IRA then has jurisdiction, governing powers over that land. And I guess my initial assumption is that if the IRA now has governing powers over village-owned land, then it continues to have that governing power. And as a first run at it, if the IRA government does not now have jurisdiction, governing jurisdiction over village-owned lands, that it probably won't acquire that by the transfer of the land to the IRA unless the land is somehow pulled back into trust by the government. Now, that's the first time I've sort of anticipated that question, so if you or David or some Bart has some comment on it. But that's a governance question, which we really weren't planning to go into depth on today.
Okay. All I'm saying is, I guess, I thought it was, as usual, a clear and lucid discussion to which I wouldn't add anything. I think the hard and controversial question is probably the governance one.
Well,
the hardest.
Yeah, David, and then Tony, and then Bart.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, I don't think I agree with Ralph on the effect of the tribe owning the land. It may well make a difference. It seems to me it might. The question that keeps it.
This awful metaphor about clothes. But anyhow, I think we need to recognize the fact that under current corporate status, you know, there are a lot of protections that are already available to the skillful corporation manager. I mean, our corporation obviously does not take risk back into our parent corporation. As Liz suggests, we have a development corporation in which we're a joint venture partner with some other folks, and when we want to do a subdivision or a shopping center, we take the land and we send it over there, and that's the group that, you know, absorbs all the risk. So there are ways that skillful people can, you know, and skillful corporation managers can go through that now. The real problem is that we have some corporations that have not reached that level of sophistication yet. And I'm afraid that, you know, those corporations particularly are looking for some kind of corporate structure or some kind of situation, be it corporate, cooperative, IRA, or whatever, that is totally, completely bomb-proof as far as losing their land. Well, I guess I'd just like to run up a red flag, and that is there's no such thing as a bomb-proof situation. If you think that IRAs or federal trust are bomb-proof, I suggest you go talk to some of the tribes in the lower 48 who were terminated. Nothing is forever. Nothing is bomb-proof. Everything is going to take diligent effort and diligent following by the people involved to make sure that it works, no matter what the structures may be. I think we've also come to the point where it's very obvious that we need a variety of options. Not only do we need a variety of options which different corporations may use, but I think we also need a variety of options that one single corporation can use. I can see a village coming up to the point where they have, like our village, a development corporation, an IRA which is dealing with part of the land, and maybe a cooperative that is dealing with part of the land also. I think we need to look at mixes of the options within a single village as well as a mix within this entire state. I don't think that we have the luxury of having no action as an option. I think that in some cases, villages that are existing now, village corporations will do well. They'll continue on to the future. They'll become a significant part of Alaska's economy and the social fabric, and they will serve their villages well. Other villages, I'm afraid, are not in that situation, and no action is just not an option, I don't think, for those villages. To return to what I said before, I think that no matter what structure or no matter what option we structure or what option or structure a village chooses to use, the only thing that is going to protect that village into the future is diligence and perseverance on the part of those village members. I mean, they're going to have to watch what's going on. They're going to have to pay attention to what is happening, not only to them in their village, but also to the village corporation, the corporation structures within state and federal law. It's going to be an ongoing duty and burden to, you know, keep observing what is happening so that essentially they don't end up getting worked into a corner. And I think that despite all of our moving towards trying to find the bomb-proof structure and developing lots of different options, I think that the only thing that is going to ensure that lands which village corporations or the native corporations received under the Claims Act remains in native hands is a true dedication by those natives involved that is what's going to happen. I think that with that basic dedication by the people involved, I think that we can orchestrate and build structures that will let it happen. But without that basic dedication, I'm afraid no structure is going to protect them and carry them forward.
Yeah, we've looked at the for-profit corporation, the non-profit, the cooperative, the IRA, and to use Elizabeth's expression, I hope I won't get shot for this, but in December we're bringing some people here from the lower 48 and from other countries to talk about the devices they've used, the legal mechanisms they've used. Maybe none of these alternatives that we've discussed is adequate. Let's see what other people around the world are doing. And it's important enough to make sure we look at all of those alternatives. Rosemarie, you're next.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come here because I haven't participated very much, but I have learned a lot just by listening. The Doyon region has very few IRAs. They are mostly traditional councils. And I would like to point out that it's very important to get all the questions out before you act, because I learned the hard way. The state told the community of Northway that there was money available for community projects at the unincorporated community aid, and that the village councils did not qualify for that money, even though Northway is 80% Native people and 20% white. They were not incorporated, so they didn't qualify for the money. So they said we had to set up a nonprofit corporation for this money specifically, which we did. And then some more money came along from the state, and they said, okay, we no longer recognize the village council. The nonprofit is the only corporation we will recognize for state money. So there are twists that you have to look at before you act. And now the traditional council is upset with me as the president of the nonprofit. But we try to work together. We have
legislation that you helped put together, Dan, and what you were talking about, Elizabeth, there's some shifts in in the deadlines for proxies and proxy statements and getting voter lists out and getting access to shareholder lists. There's also some changes in the lengths of times, I believe, that we're playing with here. The real question is, assuming that we're going to have corporations surviving beyond 1991, might there not be some differences that we may want to look at in those timelines and different management options as to when they have to start doing some of this to be in a much more protective position than we are right now? I know under the new corporate statutes, we got a little more leeway, and there's some differences there. But the question always comes up, for instance, in cumulative, non-cumulative voting, there may have to be a switch to protect, you know, now we're trying to look out for minorities issues sometimes. We may want to turn around and put it all to protect the majority. How about in this proxy area? Are there some areas that we ought to look at that we may want to shift into a little later on?
That is really a tough question for me to answer. As I tried to think through, as you know, in talking to me, I've always thought of the belt and suspenders approach, which is we would do certain things in federal law, and at the same time, we would do certain things in state law so that if anyone failed, something else would cover us. All I meant was, I in terms of looking at the state law issue, I had only looked really at a narrow number of options that are traditional in the anti-takeover area, such as supermajorities, such as making sure that if someone owned more than 100 shares, that it wouldn't be one share, one vote. Those are the two, ability to change your articles so that when you were considering mergers, you could consider non-monetary considerations. Anyway, in some ways, I know these words are just rolling off people's backs. All I'm suggesting to you, John, is that I had never really, I don't have an answer for you because I'd never sat back and analyzed a change in these other aspects and how that would work.
Well, some of Dan's new proposals in the new proposed corporate statutes do make some significant shifts in the timelines. And I'm just wondering whether, Dan, you've had a chance to think through any of those or how a corporation might want to shift back and forth in those, or how the state law may want to change a little to be much more defensive.
Well, I'm not positive that I'm tracking what you're asking me. And I mean, one thing that the proposed new corporation code would do, which is not found in the other one, the existing law, which I think would be an advantage to anybody concerned with corporations, is it standardizes time requirements on notices to shareholders. Notices must be given a minimum of 20 days prior to the corporate action that you propose to take, and it cannot be more than 60 days prior to the corporate action. It's abusive if you wait until the last minute to mail something to someone knowing they're not going to get it. It can be equally abusive if you mail me something 6 months ahead of time as an invitation to a party, for I shall surely lose track of the date and lose the invitation and won't show up. So the Act standardizes that, and you don't have, whereas the current statute has different time frames for different actions, and people have to worry about whether this is a 10 and 50 day requirement, a 20 and 50 day requirement, there would be standard requirements, and I think that will make life a great deal simpler. With respect to proxies, the Act does not attempt to substantively interfere with the legislation that Elizabeth was primarily responsible for. It does clarify the nagging question of when a proxy is irrevocable. It says that proxies have no life beyond 11 months, so that no one can sit there and say, well, I have for a second annual meeting your proxy. The proxy cannot last beyond 11 months. For periods of revocation, it ties them to specific interests and makes clear when it is that proxy can be revoked. It clarifies such things as that if the proxy person who gave the proxy actually shows up in person at the meeting, the fact that she's walked in the room revokes the proxy and she can vote her own shares. I mean, a lot of questions which at the present time are left in a sort of vacuous state. We don't know the answer in Alaska. An attorney, or indeed a far better idea than an attorney, a director of a corporation or a shareholder or an officer of a corporation could look at the law and read it and say, yes, if you come to the meeting, you can vote your shares in person. It also says that if you've given more than one proxy, the proxy which was given last in time controls. I mean, it is a much more detailed provision than existing law in those areas. But it does not deal with the disclosure requirements. What the new Act would do is to make it easier for shareholders to gain access, meaningful access, to the books so that they could see who the other shareholders were, where they lived. It streamlines the circumstances under which shareholders have a right to inspect those books, and I think it puts in meaningful consequences if they are denied those rights.
The thing is, the question that John raises goes sort of to the to, as I say, I think the center of the conundrum. As long as we assume that what we've got is almost, if you like, a closed system where you're dealing with native shareholders, that anything that is pro-shareholder rights tends to be something that most of us would be for and say in the long run would be for the health of the corporation. For example, I recall that in the present proposal, there is a proposal to remove directors without cause. That is a pro-shareholder provision.
In this regard, there are village corporations that have operations in they own the subsurface, or they own the surface state, and the regional corporation owns the subsurface. There's village corporate, I don't know how that's relevant, but there's village corporation directors who are also regional corporation directors, or there are village corporation officers who are also regional corporation directors or officers. In other words, there's with the limited number of talented bodies out there, there's going to be inevitably a group of people who are in conflicting playing conflicting roles. And I don't have an easy answer for that kind of situation. I don't know if there is one.
The question of a conflict of interest is very vexing, and one of the biggest problems with existing Alaska corporation law is there are no statutory provisions on conflicts of interest. And so we begin without guidance, which is found in the law of most other states. The conflict of interest problem arises from an assumption, which is a common law assumption, that a director owes to the corporation on the board of which he or she sits what is called both a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. Conflict of interest is primarily a manifestation of the common law idea of a duty of loyalty. The director is supposed to deal in exercising the authority of the office of director in such a manner as the director in good faith believes is in the best interest of the corporation and is to be guided by no other perceptions of interest or advantage in making up his or her mind, so that the director's loyalty is owed to the corporate entity, not to the shareholders that elected the director, not to the family, certainly not to any personal advantage which the director might perceive is being obtained, but is owed in theory to the corporation. Well, how can an individual serve on the board of two corporations? And if those, well, there is no problem so long as the two corporations do not deal with one another. But if the two corporations deal with one another, and I happen to be serving on the board of each, how can I, on behalf of the corporation that is the buyer in the transaction, devote my single-minded loyalty to seeking out terms most advantageous to the buyer, while at the same time acting as a director of the corporation that would be the seller, those terms which are most advantageous to the seller in what is essentially an adversarial negotiation? Right? Now, as I say, Alaska law doesn't solve the problem, and that is that's a great difficulty, because a director worries about the potential of being accused and sought to be held personally liable for violating a standard which is articulated in some after-arising judicial opinion. The proposed provisions of the Corporation Code pending in the legislature, which will be reintroduced in January, contain provisions which you'll want to look at, Section 478. Section 478 is entitled Director Conflict of Interest. It divides conflict of interest into two categories. what are called conflicts of interest, in which the director's problem is that she has a personal, material, financial interest. If there is a material financial interest, that is regarded as a primary conflict of interest. If the only problem is that the director does not have a material financial interest in the transaction, but the impediment is that I serve on the boards of two corporations that are in this transaction, then that is also perceived as a conflict of interest, but not nearly as potentially serious a conflict of interest. There are different standards for validating the transaction, depending upon whether the difficulty is that the director has a personal primary conflict of interest, or merely this institutional secondary conflict of interest, the common director problem. Now, where you need answers to the following questions. Can such a director attend the meeting? Can the attendance of the director be counted in ascertaining whether a quorum of the board is present? Can such a director participate in the discussion of the proposition? And finally, can such a director vote on whether the board approves or disapproves the transaction and have that vote counted? Now, those are the classical questions which the law has wrestled with. The statute seeks to answer every one of them. Yes, whether or not the problem is that the director has a personal primary conflict of interest or merely this secondary common directorship conflict, the director may attend the meeting. Yes, the director's presence may be counted in ascertaining the quorum. Yes, the director may participate in discussing the transaction. Can the director vote? Yes. Can the director's vote be counted? No, never. The vote of the